This is the main show, and you are listening to the Archery Maniacs Podcast.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You'll never have the sacred stone.
This is Brian Barney.
Hey everybody, I'm Christy Titus.
This is John Stallone.
We launched an updated website at www.archerymaniacs.com. Go there and you will find Archery Maniac Taxidermy. Our taxidermy includes European mounts, hydrographic skull dips, and custom artwork, customizable video packages to fit all your hunt needs, monthly newsletter. The newsletter will include success stories, failure stories, gear reviews, wild game recipes, upcoming episodes in our online series, and upcoming podcasts, and updates to our YouTube online series called Live Life at Full Draw. Alert, alert! Soon to launch our ebooks, Hunt Planner Guide, all the steps you need to plan your next DIY dream hunt, including specific questions, hunt plans, and step-by-step instructions. Keto Dehydration, make your own dehydrated keto meals for your hunting and backpacking adventures. Super Tune Your Bow, Beginner's Bow Tuning Guide, and more. Thank you for tuning into the show, and we appreciate you checking out the website. Do you suffer from target panic? Has buck fever affected your shot control at the moment of truth? Learn the science of shot control at ShotIQ.com. Joel Turner's controlled process shooting program will give you the tools to succeed in extreme stress shooting situations. Decide to succeed with ShotIQ. In this episode, Cale Staton interviews Mike Clifton. Mike is the owner of New Mexico Elk Hunts. That is at newmexicoelkhunts.com. And they talk about what it's like to be an outfitter, how he fits in his own hunting, some hunting tactics, New Mexico draw process and odds, increase in archery popularity, Barbary sheep hunting, needed gear, and more. I hope you enjoy the show.
Okay, hi. This is Mike Clifton with Triple C Outfitters from Artesia, New Mexico, and you're listening to Archery Maniacs.
Awesome, man. Well, this is Cale Staton, also with Archery Maniacs, and I appreciate you coming on with me tonight. Man, it's been a while.
It has. Last time I saw you, we had a pretty good time up in the mountains.
Oh, yeah. So I was fortunate enough to find Michael several years ago, and got to go on an elk hunt with my dad, and that's one of my most cherished memories ever is spending those days in the mountains there in New Mexico hunting with you, man. I mean, that was a pretty awesome experience, and I tell people about it all the time.
Yeah, that was definitely a hunt that I'll never forget. You know, it seems like those wilderness hunts in New Mexico are always the ones that get burned into your mind. Between the big bulls and the crazy snowstorm that dumped on us, it was pretty wild times.
For sure it was. Yeah, it was, man. I mean, I got broke in quick. I never got to go on a hunt like that in my life. And honestly, I haven't been back since with kids and kid activities and stuff. I haven't been able to come out west and hunt since that time. So, it was a great hunt. And I'm going to get to go out this year for the first time since I hunted with you. And chase elk again, but it was something I'll never forget. Some of these things I spent a week with you in the woods and we talked a lot, but I really didn't talk to you about what kind of hunting you do. I've got you on Facebook and stuff, and I see that you do hunt. I know your wife. I guess your wife does too. Do you archery hunt?
Yeah, you know, I kind of do it all, Cale. You know, here in New Mexico, that's kind of the biggest thing that can help you as far as drawing tags is just kind of being versatile when it comes to your weapon choice. So growing up, I archery hunted and rifle and muzzleloader hunted. So I kind of, typically apply for rifle hunts as my first choice and then back those up with some good archery and muzzleloader hunts just because those typically have a little better success odds and drawing the tags. But my family loves to hunt. My wife got into archery hunting. She grew up in a hunting family, but she never hunted. And a few years ago, she picked up a bow and started shooting it and fell in love with it and has been on a couple successful elk hunts since then. And so, we have a lot of fun hunting together as a family for sure.
That's awesome. So what, well, really, how much do you get to hunt? I mean, you're an outfitter, so you hunt a lot, but personally,
yeah,
how much yeah, do you personally get to go out?
Not near as much as I used to. You know, it's really hard. You got to get creative. You know, I've been, there's some opportunities in Arizona, some late season archery hunts that don't conflict with any hunt dates here in New Mexico. There's also some late season muzzleloader elk hunts that I've gotten into applying for, just mainly because they don't conflict with a lot of our trophy elk hunts here in our main unit. So you kind of got to be creative and think outside the box. The Barbary sheep's been a really good tag because we've gotten super busy, but that tag's valid for the whole month of February. So typically, even in a really busy season where we may have 8 to 10 clients coming in, I might still be able to find a couple day window here and there between different hunts, hunters arriving and leaving, where I can get out and do some hunting. But yeah, it's getting harder and harder each day. I was talking to a guy today, and you know, I got all these bonus points and preference points built up in all these Western states, and I just keep buying them, not because, you know, I want more points, but because I just don't have time to, you know, hunt these states and do the hunts that I thought I'd be able to do 10 years ago.
Right. I mean, a lot of people think, and including me, that being a guide or an outfitter is kind of a dream job. But, man, if you love hunting, you want to hunt too.
So. That's the truth, man. That's the truth. Yeah, you know, it's always great being out in the field with clients and letting them experience, you know, these animals for their first time, and they just get such a rush out of it. And that's great. We love that. But like you said, there's nothing better than being behind the scope every now and then for yourself.
For sure. I got a little excited when my dad shot that elk, didn't I? What did I do? Do you remember what I did? I remember.
I don't remember.
I tackled your ass, man. I remember that. I remember I grabbed you and tackled you because I heard my dad shooting over the hill there. I still get that excited, by the way. But no, I make it a point to every year I take somebody out new hunting, whether it's an adult or a kid, and I know you have to feel the same way when they're aiming at an animal or fixing to shoot an animal. My heart is beating just as hard as theirs is. And so I couldn't imagine, you know, you get to do that every week or a few months on end, being able to take people out and have them take their own animals. I mean, it's exciting to me. You know, even if it's a person that's hunted before, if I get to take them out to my lease or take them hunting and they get to kill something, it's a pretty awesome experience.
Oh yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Especially the youth hunters, getting them involved and, you know, seeing them out in the field is always such a good thing to do and such a good, you know, sign for the future of hunting, that there's no better substitute. We love that New Mexico is one of the greatest states for youth hunting opportunities with some of the hunts they have for elk and mule deer and known separate youth antelope and turkey season. So the youth hunters is what we love. We love all hunters, but the youth hunts, like you said, there's nothing greater than being next to a young, you know, boy or girl when they harvest their first, you know, turkey or mule deer or even gigantic elk here in New Mexico. So right. You just never.
That's crazy. That's it is to see the kids' emotions and the things they go through and how excited they get it's a pretty awesome experience, especially now that, you know, I got kids and you have grown kids. So
yeah. Yep.
shoot. I guess I think my buddy got with you and he told me he was going to and apply for both of his kids for licenses this year. Mark Richardson.
Yeah. I think he applied last year and we were unsuccessful, but they're back in again this year. So we'll keep our fingers crossed, but yeah, those, right now it's application season here in New Mexico, so we're kind of about a little under 2 weeks away from the application deadline. So everyone's kind of scrambling, trying to figure out what hunts they want to apply for now that Wyoming's elk draw results came out about 2 weeks ago, I guess, and yeah. Arizona haven't officially come out yet, but they're due out here pretty soon.
Yeah, I put in for the Wyoming draw and was unsuccessful. I had only had one point though, but I still try to put in for it to see what. So now I have 2 points for next year. But I was just trying to draw a general elk tag and was not successful. But
that's a great strategy, you know. In Wyoming, don't feel bad. I was unsuccessful as well, and I'm up to 12 preference points or bonus points for elk in Wyoming. So if I had it to do over again, Kel, what your plan is the one that makes sense, you know. Try to pick an area that you can draw every 3 to 5 years, and then you'll have the opportunity to go back and learn it and hunt it a couple times, and your chances of killing a big bull are probably going to be a lot better than waiting for the ultra premium unit like I've been chasing for 12 years where, you know, any little thing, I mean, it's such a short hunt window, you know, a big snowstorm could completely wreck your hunt that you've been waiting over a decade for. So,
it's just
a tough deal, but yeah, you got to buy those preference points in all the Western states and just hope to get lucky.
Yep. Yep. Zach Harrell, the main host of Archery Maniacs, lives in Wyoming. So he may or may not be helping me. He for sure is going to be helping me when I finally get drawn in Wyoming is what's going on. So that's why we applied there. So that'll help me out. We're actually going to go be hunting in Colorado this year over the counter tags. He's going to take me up there and kind of show me the ropes for an archery hunt in September. He says he's going to kill me because something about an 8 to 9 mile hike in with just a backpack, and I don't know what the hell is going to go on with that.
sounds like he has a plan.
you took me 9 miles in, but we had horses. He said, I don't get to have a horse this time, so.
Yeah, those horses definitely help, you know. We got a couple horses and mules now, and you know, we're lucky where the main units where we're elk hunting now are really trophy quality units here in New Mexico, and we're pretty blessed that the terrain's very moderate compared to the stuff that you and your dad hunted with us. So
Right. You
really don't even need a horse or to even think about a horse or a mule until you actually get your elk down, and we pretty much just use them to pack meat and horns off the mountain. But some of those areas in Colorado, man, they can be pretty steep.
So what units are you, without giving up?
Yes. So our elk units that we mainly focus on are units 34 and unit 36, and those are in the Lincoln National Forest in the south central part of New Mexico.
Okay.
They're just really high quality units, mainly because those two units border the Mescalero Apache Indian Reservation. And the Mescalero Apache Indian Reservations has been well known over the last 40 years for just phenomenal trophy quality Rocky Mountain elk. And so the genetics off the reservation have spread over the last 40 years onto the surrounding public land, and there's just elk everywhere now. And really, really nice quality bulls coming out of the unit. So like I said, it's a good combination because it's not real steep. Most of the units aren't real steep, and you can glass a long way, so it makes for a good hunt. You see a lot of elk. It's pretty much the exact opposite of where we hunt at Kel, where we were up high and you really, you know, had all the dark timber and, you know, only open stuff down in the bottoms, the valleys and stuff like that. These units are a lot different. They're more kind of desert country is what I would describe. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
But they, you know, they produce some enormous elk. You get out there and guys don't believe you that elk live out there because you're looking around and it looks like, you know, mule deer or Barbary sheep country. There's cactus and choya and yuccas and agaves and 350 plus inch bulls as well. So it's it's pretty crazy.
That is. How so the New Mexico draw process for out of staters, what is the process and kind of what's your typical draw odds, you know? And I know you don't get preference points in New Mexico. So kind of, you know, generalize, you know, what is the process and the odds like?
Yeah, sure. So basically, as a non-resident here in New Mexico, when you're looking at applying for any big game tag, whether it's elk, deer, antelope, oryx, ibex, there's basically, you're going to be looking at, you know, as you, if you apply as a non-resident do-it-yourself hunter, 6% of the tags for any given hunt go to a non-resident do-it-yourself hunter. So those draw odds are pretty low because there's a lot of do-it-yourself guys that can't afford to hire an outfitter or a guide. So there's a lot of guys applying, and only 6% of the total tags go to those do-it-yourself non-residents. When you apply as a non-resident with a New Mexico outfitter, what happens is that routes your application to the New Mexico outfitters pool, and 10% of the tag quota is reserved for New Mexico outfitters.
Okay.
So once your application as a non-resident gets moved from that do-it-yourself pool into the outfitters pool, that's when you start seeing substantially, you know, good draw odds for really high quality units here in New Mexico. So, for example, as a do-it-yourself non-resident in our trophy quality public land archery elk units, you might have less than a 2-3% chance of drawing an archery tag. But when you get your application in through the outfitter pool, those numbers can range anywhere from 15% up to 20%. So your chances of drawing a tag just go up exponentially. And, you know, it is a true luck of the draw here in New Mexico. So there is no bonus points or preference points. So a lot of it's just kind of getting lucky, but there's lots of guys that draw their first year applying, lots of guys that have drawn 3 or 4 years in a row. And then for every one of those guys, there's also the guys that have been waiting 3 or 4 years to draw a tag.
Right. I drew my first year, me and my dad. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. I found you after I drew. So, I explained that on another podcast and kind of how I went through the process to finding which units to apply for. But, I just got lucky on that first time, I guess, but thank God I did. It was an awesome hunt. So, I don't know. I haven't been into the business long enough to the New Western hunting long enough to figure out what's better, you know, points, buying points and earning those, or just being able to, you know, everybody on an equal playing field every year. You know, I couldn't give you an opinion either other way. So,
but yeah,
I guess if you've got a 15% chance through a 15-20% chance through an outfitter, it seems like you would draw once every, you know, 4 to 5 years. So it's a whole lot better than waiting 10 to 12 to 15 years to draw a premium unit in another area.
Yeah. Because like I tell guys all the time that, and guys from Arizona, a lot of guys from Arizona have started applying with us. And if our units were 300 miles further west across the Arizona, New Mexico state line, and they were located in Arizona, you would be looking at like 15 plus, you know, bonus points to have a reasonable chance of drawing a tag. So like you said, you know, I think the right answer is kind of a combination of, you know, playing the true luck of the draw lottery like New Mexico has, and then also having a couple bonus points and preference points built in some other Western states is kind of probably the perfect, you know, game plan. That's how I played, at least, so that you always have some hunts kind of in the queue. And then in New Mexico, you're always alive, you know, so you might as well throw your name in the hat. And you know, it's really a good problem to have when you draw one of these high-quality tags. it's a really good problem to have. It's not going to hurt your feelings.
No. Yeah, that's a, for sure. So how many archery hunters are you guiding a year?
You know, it just kind of depends, because like with the way the lottery is here in New Mexico, we never know, with it being true luck of the draw, who's going to draw what tags. We average, you know, on average about 18 to 25 elk hunters in our trophy quality public land units. And that's for all the seasons combined. That's archery, muzzleloader and rifle. So I would say during archery season, the last 5 years, we probably had anywhere from 8 to 10 clients spread out over the month of September. Yeah. Yeah, the units we operate, you know, are pretty, you know, are very limited tags, you know, respectively. So there's not a whole bunch of hunting, you know, tags issued. So, you know, if we have, you know, 200 to 400 hunters in camp for each week in September, that's going to be about the average for archery.
Well, that's, it seems like, well, according to your numbers, about half your elk hunters are archery.
Yeah, yeah, and it can happen that way. Like this last year, 2 years ago, we didn't have any archery hunters, but, you know, I had like 12 muzzleloader hunters that drew tags. So this year it was almost the opposite. So you just never really know. As far as the numbers of people that apply, archery hunting has become almost as popular as the rifle hunts.
Yep.
So we apply almost equal amounts, whereas 5 years ago, there was way more people that, you know, were doing rifle and they didn't want to, they weren't concerned, interested in archery, but archery's really caught on the last 5 years. And as a result of that, the archery tags are getting harder to draw. And they're actually, for the first year, last year, we saw the private land archery landowner vouchers trading or selling at a premium to the rifle vouchers, which that's never happened before in our trophy units. But yeah, if you wanted to buy a landowner archery tag, it was going to cost you about $1,000 more than the rifle landowner tag.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Just because demand, you know, just because supply and demand, there's so many people out there that just want to, you know, hunt these elk in the rut with the bow. And I can't blame them. It's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, right. For sure. Man, so as far as tactics are concerned, what would be something different? I mean, what do you do differently early season archery hunting versus what you would do maybe muzzleloader or rifle hunting?
You know, one of the biggest things that we do that's really effective in our units that we hunt is we sit water early during the archery season, because like I mentioned, the units that we hunt, there's a lot of lower desert country where it might be getting up to 90 degrees still on September 1st when archery elk season opens. And if you can find a big bull down in the desert and pattern him on his water source, there's no better time to kill a really big bull than sitting in a ground blind when it's 90 degrees out, because he's got to come to water. He probably has to come to water twice a day when it's that hot. And so that's a tactic that's really effective early on. But as the season progresses, it gets less and less effective because these bulls kind of feel the hunting pressure and they get very nocturnal on when they come to their water sources when the muzzleloader and rifle hunts are going on. But during archery season, if you can pattern a big bull off a remote water source, a guzzler or wildlife drinker, and, you know, figure out when he's coming off trail cams or what have you and brush in a ground blind and have a seat, that's a good way to kill a big bull in our country early season with the bow.
I was just about to ask you if you use trail cameras. So, okay, a kind of a crazy question. I use ground blinds a lot where I hunt in Texas because we have no trees taller than 8 feet, 8 or 10 feet, and there's no way in hell you can put a tree stand in them where we hunt. So a whitetail, if I place the tree stand up a week or a pop-up blind a week with no brushing in, they're used to it. They'll come back around it. You know, if I hunt it the day or two, the first couple days that it's up, the whitetails really won't come in front of you because they don't know what the hell it is. But even if they're a week or so, they get used to it and they don't have to come around. So is an elk different? I mean,
They're probably a little less, keen to that than probably a whitetail. But we like to kind of brush our stuff in at least 2 or 3 days before we're going to put a hunter in there.
Okay.
And, set a blind up. A lot of times, honestly, the elk don't even see you. What it is there's a lot of beef cows in the areas that use these drinkers as well on these public lands.
Right.
And the beef cows are the ones that'll give you the stink eye and cause a big, they'll basically put everything on edge because they're just standing there at the drinker staring at the blind. You know, I mean, I know if a bull came running in to get a drink of water, he probably wouldn't notice it, you know, 99 out of 100 times. But if, you know, 20 cows are standing there staring, so, you know.
I know elk, exactly what you're talking about.
You know, they're not near as keen on that. You know, you could probably get away with putting up a blind the day, you know, that you're going to sit, which is what some guys do, because a lot of times, you know, we're hunting public land. And so people, unfortunately, do steal stuff out there. And if you go set up a blind a couple days before you plan on putting a client in there, it may or may not be there when you go back. So, you know, the elk tend to be a little less keen on that kind of stuff. But, you know, mule deer will give you a little bit of a stink eye if you try to put something up real quick on them. And I definitely heard the same on whitetail.
Yep. Whitetail will. The first, if you hunt, I've hunted a stand the first day I've set it up, and they won't even, I mean, they'll come in and look straight at you and just stare at you about 30 yards and will not even turn or nothing. And they typically walk away. They don't ever get comfortable. So, yeah, whitetails do not like the biggest thing they don't like is the black spot. So if you have a window open, they don't like the black, the hole. So if you have the, so if you have that shoot through mesh or something, which I will never use, they tend to not bother them as much. But that big black hole in that camouflage side of a pop up tends to bother them. So I'll put the pop up up and leave the window open and just hope an owl or something doesn't get in there and take a roost in my stand. But I never even thought about using a pop up blind for elk. I mean, that's awesome. You know?
It's good. You know, and a lot of times you don't even need the blind in a lot of our places, but it's just being in the blind for a lot of most of our elk hunters are coming from back east. And so they're used to, you know, shooting from a blind or shooting from a tree. And so they like that controlled environment. It's really hard because lots of times elk, unless they're looking directly at you, they won't pick up on you drawing your bow, or slight movements that a whitetail will bust you, you know, instantly on. An elk won't pick that up. So a lot of times if you have a hunter that's not used to hunting elk and they just mainly hunt whitetail, a lot of times if they're not in a blind and you just have them kind of standing or kneeling up against a tree or in some brush, a lot of times the shot opportunity will come and go and they won't even realize that it, because they think that they can't get away with any movement, you know, when a lot of times you can. So we like to put them in the blind because it's comfortable to them. You know, it's a controlled environment. They can get drawn, all that good stuff, and less chance of the elk seeing them. But, you know, a lot of times when you're running and gunning, you know, you might chase a bull all morning and never catch up to him, but he goes up to bed on a north face slope and you know he's going to come down and hit some water, you know, somewhere between where you're at and where he's at, and you can find that water source. We'll just get down there and try to get tucked into a little spot and maybe, you know, brush ourselves in with some brush and get ready for hopefully a elk coming to water. So it's a pretty effective tactic early on in the season.
It sounds like it. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it. How much calling do you do early season?
You know, it just varies. Like the last 3 years, the elk in our premium units have been screaming their heads off September 1st. So, you know, I've called in bulls the last 3 years, multiple bulls September 1st the last 3 years. So it just kind of depends. I would consider, I'm more of kind of a moderate caller. I'm not very aggressive, but at the same time, I'm not super quiet. I just kind of mix it up. I definitely do more cow calling than bugling in our units. But, you know, we do quite a bit on it, actually, you know, throughout the whole archery season, as far as cow talk and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That really, noise travels really well in a lot of that lower desert country. And if you can, you know, give them some reassurance, a big herd bull, some reassurance that some cows are nearby and he's used to that, then that just kind of helps settle them in sometimes. They may not necessarily come running into your calls, but, you know, it'll help them kind of ease into maybe a water hole or a wallow or something to that effect.
You still have that necklace full of different calls, I'm sure, don't you?
I got about 10 of those necklaces.
I remembered you had like, you know, 6 to 10 different calls on that thing, and it made complete sense when you explained to me, you know, why don't you explain to everybody what I just talked about? You know, why do you have the different calls on the on your lanyard around your neck? You know, why different cow calls?
Yeah, just because, like, if you naturally ever had the chance to listen to elk, you know, talking in their natural environment, they all sound so different. So all the calls, a Primo's call is going to sound different from, you know, another one. And they all sound just slightly different. And the elk can really pick up on those subtle differences. So if you have multiple calls and you change your calling position and cover them and kind of use your hands to throw those calls directionally, you can really trick the elk into believing, a bull elk into believing a herd of cows. Not only one elk, but a herd, multiple cow elk and calves are coming through his area. And in September, that's almost a recipe that's too hard for most bulls to resist. A group of cows coming through, they got to come check it out and see, you know, what the situation is. So multiple calls just make it sound like multiple elk. And a lot of the big bulls, they won't come. They won't leave their cows just to come get one elk, you know. But if you can convince them that, hey, maybe there's 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 over here in this, you know, patch of trees, and that may be what it takes to get them to come over there and, you know, take those last fatal steps into archery range. So we just always have used a lot of calls. We obviously have our go-to calls, ones that we all, that, you know, are our favorites, but variety is always the best. And, you know, I diaphragm call a lot. I have reed calls, you name it, I'll use it. And they're all good, you know, they're all good for that reason, just variability.
Right. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you just think about a human. If you know somebody, you know what their voice sounds like. So most of the time, you know, your friend calls you on the phone. You don't have to, they don't say, hey, this is Joe. You know, it's Joe on the phone because of their voice, you know. And so elk, any animal has to be the same, you know. They recognize voices. We recognize voices as humans. That makes sense that, you know, 6 to 8 different calls sound 6 to 8 for different ways to that dang elk that's standing out there. So, you know, it just makes sense. It may sound similar to a human. An elk call may sound similar to us because we are not used to listening to those different sounds and stuff, but it just makes sense, man. When you told me that day, I was like, that just makes sense. I mean, I never thought of it, but it just makes sense. So that's, yeah, you know, it's perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of like turkey hunting too. You know, I mean, like, you know, we carry slate calls, we carry box calls, we carry it all, right? Diaphragm calls. And, you know, some days they just hammer back at certain calls, and some days they shun them. And so it's always good to have plenty of tools in your toolbox when you're going to work. So we like to use a lot of calls.
You know, it's funny. The more people I talk to that elk hunt a lot, you know, you watch TV and you watch a hunting show. On every hunting show you watch, the elk get called in and they get shot. But it seems like every elk hunter I talk to that hunts elk a lot either ambush hunts or stalks them. And they don't, they call just to locate. And it seems more like that's the more realistic way. I guess on TV, if you're trying to film a hunt, you need the elk to come to you. But if in reality, it seems like, you know, it's more effective to go to them or ambush hunt them. You know, it just seems like I'm just going by the conversations that I've had, you know, with people here in the last 6 months. You know, it seems like more people are ambush hunting or spot and stalking or using the calls to locate and then getting in close and, you know, finishing the job that way.
Yeah, no doubt, man. No doubt. Because, you know, I mean, there's such a short window of time in the month of September as the buildup to the rut's happening and these elk are kind of starting to lose their minds, these big bulls, where there's only a short period of time where they're going to come to the calls, you know, where you're going to be able to call them in on a string and pull them right past your client at 40 yards. And, you know, that sweet spot might happen for 7 days, let's say, during the whole month of September. So for us as guides, we're out there the whole month and we get to see that. But, you know, and the guys that are filming the hunts on private land and even on public land, if they get lucky and hit that sweet spot, then it looks too easy, right? You call a bull in, drop back 100 yards, set your hunter up, and here they come, you know, yep. And you can just roll in bull after bull after bull. And that does happen. I mean, we do see that for at least 5 to 7 days every September, where no matter what you do, you can pretty much call a bull in, multiple bulls in every morning and evening. But it's such a small window that you got to be versatile, because – you know, once that period passes, the big bulls aren't going to come into your calls. You're going to be doing what you said. You're going to be getting up early and high, getting high in the morning and doing your locator calls and then trying to get a visual on them. And then it's more of a spot in stock or an ambush type hunt if you can figure out kind of what that bull's doing. So, yeah, some of the best elk hunters that I've ever been around have never put a call anywhere near their lips. They don't call elk. They just listen, you know, and they're phenomenal archery hunters. They've killed enormous bulls, you know, multiple 370, 380 plus bulls, and they don't know the first thing about calling elk other than squeaking on a hoochie mama.
Right.
So, you know, but they just go where they know they're going to be and use their optics and listen, and when they, you know, get on a bugling bull, then they start coyoting in with the wind in their favor. And believe it or not, it sounds like a pretty impossible task to do, but with a little bit of practice, it's pretty easy to sneak right into a herd of elk if you got the wind in your face.
Yeah.
So you can definitely do it, and you can get right up in there and mix it up with them. And that's what a lot of guys do that kill those big herd bulls, because the herd bulls, once they get their cows, your chances of being able to pull them away, no matter what you're, you know, saying to them on your diaphragm or read call, they're just not going to come, you know. They're not going to leave 100 cows to come see 5 or 6.
No. I mean, that just makes sense, you know. Mm-hmm. That what you just described there is my perfect, exact, my personality. That's my hunting. I'm the worst turkey hunter in the world. Because I am so aggressive when I turkey hunt, I scare the damn birds away. Every person I take turkey hunting kills something. When I go turkey hunting, I don't kill anything because I'm too aggressive. But I would much rather locate them and make a move on them. You know, that sounds exactly like my personality and the way I would, you know, hunt. And that's the way I, you know. My plan is every year from now until I can't do it anymore to hunt out west. I've made that decision and I've talked to my wife about it, and that's what I'm doing. And what you just described in the last few minutes is exactly how I'm going to hunt them. I mean, just because that's my personality, and I want to be aggressive, and I want to, you know, get in on them with my feet, you know, and just stalk in. You know, that's what hunting. That's my favorite thing about hunting. You know, I love sitting in a stand and I love shooting whitetail and I love everything about that. I really do. But my favorite hunts are on my feet, on the move, trying to maneuver and outthink my prey, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do, you know, and I'm excited right now. I'm ready to go.
Hey, me too, man. Me too.
I just got back from a little hunt. You know, I just got back from South Texas hunting javelina, and that's what we did all week, was spot and stalk javelina. I'm ready to go back right now, and that's exactly how we hunted them. You know, we got the wind in our favor and tried to get in on them close with our bows. So, but
yeah,
man, that's, I'm ready to go. shoot. So, you obviously, we've been talking the last, you know, 30 minutes about hunting elk, but you also outfit mule deer, all dad sheep, and then did I hear you mention oryx or
Yep, we do. Yeah, New Mexico has a lot of everything here with the exotics. So we got the ibex, the Persian ibex. We have oryx, or African gemsbuck. We have the audad, Barbary sheep, as they call them here in New Mexico. Mule deer, antelope, and elk is okay. Basically, you know, our kind of gamut. And you know, our biggest seasons are definitely our elk season, and then the Barbary sheep has become really popular here in New Mexico. And we grew up, where I grew up, about 20 miles from there is kind of the heart of sheep country. So we've always been fascinated with chasing these sheep around since I was a little kid. And, you know, there's some really nice ones out there now on public land. There's probably no better time to kill a big sheep on public land. But the hunting pressure over the last decade or so has just really increased because there's, you know, obviously there's a lot of public land and there's a lot of nice ones out there. So hunters are willing to work harder than ever before to try to find them. And, you know, it's always fun, but it's the whole month of February here in New Mexico. The tag's valid for the whole month of February. And you know, there's usually a pretty good reason they give you that much time because they get pushed around pretty good once the hunting season starts. But, you know, they're sheep. You just kind of find them where you find them, right? So,
right. So I've had the opportunity to hunt Aldad or here in Texas a few times. It low fence in the mountains. I guarantee you it's very similar to where you're hunting. But you know, Texas hasn't figured out how to make money off these things yet, man. They're a pest to Texas, and you basically just have to have a small game license, and you can kill an unlimited amount of Aldad sheep in Texas when you're hunting. But you know, what's the population like? You know, where you're hunting, do you see Aldad every day, or is it tough to find them, or
you know, it's if you so typically we'll see Aldad every day. We'll find the sheep every day early on in the season. But what will happen is a lot of the key area that they occupy is a lot of checkerboard, public and private. And so what happens is the public land hunters will hunt and they'll bounce the sheep over onto the private, and then the private guys will hunt the following week and they'll bounce the sheep back onto the public. So they kind of just get pushed around. And, you know, once about a week into the season, it really becomes kind of a 50-50 proposition on finding them, you know, because they may just be pushed onto a big private ranch and you're just not going to see them unless they happen to be hunting and push them back onto public. And so, you know, we average about the last 3 years, we've averaged 75% shot opportunity on a 4 day hunt on 26 inch or better public land rams. So most of our guys will see sheep and get an opportunity at a ram. But, you know, sheep hunting's tough. And, you know, there's some weeks where we may walk 40 miles and we may never find a ram that's worth shooting, you know. So you just never really know with them. It's always better to come early rather than later, but, you know, they definitely move around quite a bit once they feel the hunting pressure.
Yeah, I can see that. They could disappear in a second. They can run on cliff ledges that I've never – I could imagine. I've seen them run on a ledge that's an inch or two wide. I swear it's an inch or two wide, and they're just running full speed on the side of a cliff, and it's unbelievable. And some of these big rams I've seen down that had their horns broomed off on the ends because they're so used to running on the sides of the cliffs. It's just these animals are tough.
Yeah.
They're tough to kill too. They're tough animals that way too.
They are. We always, you know, all our clients always kind of look at us, especially the guys from back east, when we get to talking to them about just how tough they are. And when they hit one, we're going to be telling them like an elk to keep shooting until we say stop. And, right, you know, they never really take this serious until they see how those things take a 7 mag or a 300 in the side and act like they got stung by a little bee, you know.
Yeah.
Those African game animals have a will to live that's unmatched by anything I've ever hunted in North America. I know that much.
It's crazy. Yeah. So have you hunted, have you guided any archery hunters on the All Dead Sheep?
You know, we've had a couple guys that have tried the archery hunts, none successfully though. You know, it's a pretty tall order here in New Mexico. Just because of the habitat we hunt them in, there's just not a lot of cover, and they're just so keen, you know, it's so hard to get in on them, and you can't pattern them on a water source or anything like that. So it is a true spot and stalk, but, you know, there is people that, you know, get close to rams and stick nice ones every year. I've probably been in my lifetime within archery range of, you know, a handful, 5 to 7 or 8 nice, you know, 28 plus inch rams that if I had a bow, we could have killed, you know, but it just never kind of works out that way. The biggest ram we killed this year was a ram that an archery hunter could have killed. The shot opportunity was 10 yards on him.
Right.
So, you know, but those are rare things. And most guys that come to hunt with the bow are pretty, realize that, you know, that it's going to be a pretty tall order to hunt one with the bow. I mean, heck, it's hard to kill one with a rifle, much less a bow, but it is doable, and some guys love the challenge and are willing to get out there, and we're willing to do it too. And, you know, the odds are definitely not in your favor, but hey, that's why they call it hunting. Anything can happen.
Yeah, they have to be in the perfect location. We I have been with a friend of mine. We stalked a group of All Dead. I grew the we paper rock scissors, I think, to figure out who did the stalk, and he won the match there. I think we did best two out of three. But anyway, I was with him, and we stalked a group of All Dead in West Texas in the Davis Mountains, and we were out there actually chasing mule deer, but we came up on a group of All Dead, and we got within 25 yards of them, just unbelievably lucky at where they were. They were just under the lip of a short cliff, if that made sense. I mean, you know, the cliff ledge was only probably 25 feet until it leveled off again. And so we were able to get to them, and the only shot that he was able to get on, it was a ewe, and he was able to shoot and kill a ewe, and I was able to witness it, and we got within range, and he shot and killed a ewe, and we celebrated like we just shot a 200-inch deer.
Yeah, man, that's a heck of an accomplishment, man.
No, it was pretty cool. You know, there was a couple big rams in that group, but it seemed like the rams were further off. I mean, there was a group of probably 25 All Dead, and the ones that when we popped over the cliff ledge and he stood up to make the shot, the only one that was within, you know, on this side of it was a ewe, and he just took the first shot that he had within range, and it was able to take one. It was pretty cool.
Nice.
But but no, I can definitely, they're wary as hell. I mean, every hunt that I've been on, they spotted me from like 300 yards, you know, 300 or 400 yards away. And they're looking at me trying to, you know, spot me that far away. And we're crawling to them. So, it's a tough animal to hunt. I've seen some very well known, two very well known, archers on TV try to kill them. Tim Wells and Razor Dobbs both try to kill one in Texas. They spent, over a week trying to hunt them in the Davis Mountains or West Texas, trying to kill these All Dead, and neither one of them was able to be successful in a free range situation. I mean, it was it's crazy.
Yeah, they're tough, man. Their eyesight, and they're just skittish by nature, so they're just a tough animal to kill. To kill either a ram or a ewe with a bow is a accomplishment of a lifetime, in my opinion.
Yeah. It was pretty cool to be able to witness that. So, so first time, you know, somebody's trying to come out hunt out west. What is, you know, a few things, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 things that they have to have? You know, what's some gear that if you're going to come out hunt archery hunt elk or mule deer or or antelope or whatever out west, and you're going to do a do-it-yourself hunt, you know, what are a few things that you recommend they have to have?
Yeah, so, you know, probably the most important thing that we see that ruins a lot of guys' hunts is footwear, you know, is showing up with the right type of boot or, you know, a shoe that's broken in. And, you know, it all varies on where you're hunting. Where we elk hunt, like I said, the terrain's really not that rough. I use like an athletic type trail hiking shoe. I wear like a Salomon Quest GTX, I think is what it's called. And it fits like a Nike, you know, and it's waterproof. And, you know, I don't need a big, heavy, stiff boot like I wear when I'm sheep hunting. And so, you know, I would say one of the most important things is definitely make sure that you got a boot that's going to handle and fits the terrain that you're going to be hunting in. And that'll make your hunt a lot better from, you know, every aspect of it. The other thing is high quality rain gear. You know, you definitely want to have some good rain gear in your pack because out west here, you never know. I mean, New Mexico is pretty dry, but a lot of the other states like Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, you're going to have a lot of storms that roll in on you. And if you don't have good quality rain gear, you're going to be wishing you did after about 5 minutes of a downpour. So.
Yep.
You know, I would say that's pretty important. Rangefinder. The other thing is the rain gear to be quiet too. You know, Cabela's makes them, and you know, all sorts of manufacturers make them. But you know, you want to, if you're archery hunting, you definitely rifle and muzzleloader doesn't make much of a difference. But for archery hunting, if you're having to wear rain gear, the quieter the better. So you know, that's kind of obvious, but.
The rain gear, somewhere. That is the best thing that I have from the hunt that I went on you with. I bought, it's not the most expensive rain gear, but I spent a couple $100s on a set of rain gear for the hunt with you, and I still have it, and it's still great, and it's still quiet, and it's still going to work for me when I go back to hunt this year.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I completely, the next time I buy rain gear, I'll probably spend a lot more and buy a premium set, but, It's lasted me, and it's quiet. That's the biggest thing is quiet. You know, it's got some kind of a fabric on the outside, and you know, I could do a stalk with that stuff on, and it would be no different for me wearing my normal camo. So I agree with you.
Yep.
On that.
Yeah, for sure, man. Good rain gear's, you know, worth its weight in gold when it comes down to digging in your pack looking for it. So. So the other thing is probably, you know, if you're a do-it-yourself hunter, you know, a rangefinder is kind of, you know, a thing that is surprising. A lot of guys won't show up with one. When they're with us and they're on a guided hunt, typically, you know, we'll definitely have a rangefinder. But there is plenty of situations where you may get separated from your guide. You know, your guide may only be 30 yards behind you, but a bull may come in from a little different angle than you're expecting. And just having your own rangefinder on you, you don't need the most expensive one out there or the fastest one or anything crazy, but just something that you can quickly and easily shoot yardage out to 100 yards, and you're going to be in a lot better shape than, you know, trying to guesstimate, you know, as a big bull's barreling down on you and you got 1,000 things running through your mind, having to guess yardage is just one variable that a rangefinder will definitely, you know, help with.
Yeah, for an archery hunt, you can basically almost have just about the cheapest rangefinder they make, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, for an archery hunt. For now, if you're ranging past 80 to 100 yards, you need a good rangefinder. But no, I agree with you. For an archery elk or for an archery hunt, when you're ranging something that big, I shoot competitive archery, and so I have to have a very expensive rangefinder. But the differences I've found in rangefinder pricing is the size of the object that you're ranging and the accuracy within, you know, 2 to 4 yards, 5 yards. You know, if you're shooting an elk – and it ranges it at – as long as your rangefinder – you sight in with your rangefinder, it's fine. But, you know, if it's a 2 to 3 yards difference on the rangefinder, you're shooting at a, you know, an 18-inch circle on an elk at least, you know, really a kill zone with a giant set of lungs and stuff. So I agree with you. A rangefinder does not have to be the most expensive piece of equipment you got, but you're spending – few thousand dollars on a hunt, you might as well buy a good one anyways. But
yeah. Most guys will use it for rifle hunting and other, you know, hunts too. So it just makes sense to get a little nicer one. Yes. But yeah, anything will do. You know, anything's better than nothing, I guess.
Anything's better than nothing. That was my point of saying that, you know. But there is, the price does come with quality.
Yep. So. Yep. No doubt, man. The other thing too is it's kind of a collection of things, but I kind of call it my essentials bag, and I always have it in my pack at all times. And it's just kind of, you know, my stuff that I'm gonna definitely need if I'm kill something and I'm out late on the mountain. I always like to have a headlamp with an extra set of batteries. I also have an extra set of batteries for my GPS in that little pack. A lighter and my Havilon knife with a couple replacement blades. And I know with those essentials there, I'm pretty much going to be able to, you know, find my way out, you know, take care of any animal we kill, maybe some flagging tape and some, parachute cord, but, you know, just kind of the essentials so you can make sure at a bare minimum that you got a headlamp to get out at night, you got extra GPS batteries and a lighter if you do have to spend the night on the mountain so you can start a fire.
Right. No, that makes sense. Yeah. You don't remember some of this crap, but I remember I had a whole little bundle of knives and stuff that I was going to take to break down the elk after we killed it, and my dad killed his elk, and you said, "Hey man, where's y'all's knives?" And I'm like, "In my truck, 9 miles away." And you said, "Well, I have a knife." And I think then the Havilon knife was not a popular item.
No.
And you had it, and that was the first time. If it wasn't a Havilon brand, it was the same damn thing. I remember you broke that out, and we used that to break down that elk. And I quickly, once I got back, me and my dad both have, or had, still have Havilon knives, or similar to that knife that you had that day. But when you said that was one of the things I forgot in the damn truck when we left that day.
Yeah, I think that was the prototype Havilon. I think that was the first year they came out, and yeah, it was forever ago. I still have that Havilon knife somewhere around here. So.
Yep. That's the greatest thing I've ever bought, I swear. You know, now several different companies make similar knives, and I've have a few of them now, so not just one, and they're all good. You know, the ones that I've had, so they work great.
Yeah, for sure, good tech, good things. But yeah, those would probably be my top recommendations. You know, obviously, if you're going to be backpacking into the backcountry or anything like that, you'll want a good, you know, backpacking type pack to carry your tent in and your sleeping bag and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, once you start getting into kind of those backpack do-it-yourself hunts, there's a lot of logistics and planning that go into it, because every ounce counts on those type hunts, especially if you have horses, you know, and you got to plan everything out and all your meals and everything. And you don't want to be taking in more than you need, because if you're coming out with a couple hundred pounds of meat, the less you got back there in gears, you'll be a lot happier about that.
Right. Yeah. I heard a another popular podcast host that says ounces make pounds and pounds make pain. And that's his saying. And that makes sense to me.
That's the truth, man.
So the any weight you can save is for sure needed. So anyway, yeah, that's for sure. You're exactly right on that. So man, it's been we've talked about a bunch of different stuff. It's been awesome. I'm glad to talk to you. It's been forever. I need to come hunt with you again. I think I've told several people that if you lived in Dallas or close to it, me and you'd be great friends. we got along very well. Thank goodness you didn't talk any football crap on this phone, on this podcast, because I would have hung up on you.
I do remember sitting on that mountain, and I think Donovan McNabb was on his tail end of his career in Philadelphia, and Tony Romo was on the rise, and we had some interesting thoughts.
What are the freaking chances I go hunt with somebody in New Mexico of all places, and they're a Philadelphia Eagles fan? I was like, oh my God, I'm going home.
You were a little too far in the backcountry to walk out at that point, huh? You figured you could deal with me for the next 5 days.
Right. I'm going to send you a picture of my show notes I've got written down here. The very first thing written on there is no football talk. I swear to God that's written on my notes. I'm going to text you a picture here in a minute.
That's funny, though. Because, going into the preseason, man, I really thought that, I was real envious of the Cowboys, and I still am. I think you guys got a great team, and never in a million years did I think the Philadelphia Eagles would even be anywhere near sniffing a Super Bowl, much less winning one. So that's kind of what made it cool, is that, it was just kind of so unexpected that, of course, that's how it would happen for an Eagles fan.
Right. Well, every year the Dallas Cowboys are supposed to win a Super Bowl, they finish last in the division. So every time I hear that in the preseason that they're Super Bowl favorites, I know we're going to suck. So it doesn't matter.
Shoot. Well, heck yeah, man, for sure. You'll definitely have to get back out here to New Mexico. And, the elk hunting's the main draw right now. It's never been better, to be quite honest. If you're looking to kill a big bull on public land, now's the time in New Mexico. We always hear people talk about the golden age of hunting. I think right now we're kind of living the golden age in New Mexico with our bulls, but we'll see what happens. Hopefully the trend continues upward, but right now the getting's good. So definitely need to get back out here and hopefully get you a big bull.
Yeah. The next time you see me, I'm going to be putting in for my daughter to come up there and hunt with you. That's what I'm going to do. I mean,
yeah.
You've told me, things just have not been right for me the last few years with money wise and planning. And her just being the right age, but my daughter's a killer. I'm sure you've seen her on Facebook. So she's ready now to do it to an elk hunt. She did that all dad sheep hunt this last year in Texas, and it was very similar to an elk hunt, public land, hiking in the morning, staying out all day, and coming out in the evening with backpacks and stuff. And so she was able to do that. Now she's going to be a couple of years older. We'll definitely be putting her in for an elk draw with you. But
nice.
Try to get her a big elk. I would be more excited for her killing an elk than me. So
yeah,
I would definitely tackle you again if she was able to kill an elk.
So. Hey, I'll let you tackle me all day long. If we get down to bulls, I can handle it.
Right. Shoot. Well, man, it was good talking to you on this.
Thank you for tuning into the show. It means a lot to us.
But seriously, though, I really appreciate your ear. And it would mean the world to me if you would rate our podcast. If you didn't like it, 1-star it. But if you did, a 5 is even better. Don't forget to comment, like, share, and hit that subscribe button. Thanks again for tuning into the show. Some other podcasts that you should definitely check out are
Eastman Elevating with Bride and Barney,
and Hunt Harvest Health with Ryan and Hillary Lambers.
Some other YouTube channels to check out:
Hardworking Hunter, Sterling's Extremes Outdoors, and Lane Walter Productions.
And a special thanks to
Maven Optics, Six Sight Gear, Dark Energy Tech, Shield Mountain Outdoors, The Outdoor Insiders, Iron Mind Hunting, Valkyrie Archery, and Gannett Ridge Sporting Equipment.